Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Gina.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Gina, it's going to be a good one today.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
I'm
it
excited.
Is. You know the guy, right? I mean, like, know of each other at least, or at least.
We do. Same stomping grounds.
Yeah, same
Astoria,
circles, right?
Astoria. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Very cool.
And
this guy's got a hell of a career, I think, coming up through the Coast Guard. And I'm excited to hear about some of the units that don't involve surf, even. Who we got on the line today? Mr. Jeff Rasecki, Chief Bosun Mate, retired. Born in Niagara Falls, grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1982 with recruit company Kilo 115. First unit was stationed Umpqua River. Then went to the Coast Guard Cutter Cape Shoalwater, homeport in West Palm. Then to Cape Disappointment, then the Coast Guard Cutter Elderberry out of Petersburg, Alaska, as the Executive Petty Officer. Then National Motor Lifeboat School as an instructor and later the Executive Petty Officer. And then retired with 16 and a half years on a medical retirement. Didn't get the day, but we'll ask him. And then went on to do another 20 years of public service up in the Pacific Northwest. So, Jeff, thanks for coming on. We're stoked to talk to you.
Appreciate being here.
Well, hey, we're going to ask, like we do every one of our guests, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
You know, I think at every unit I had been at, there was several incidents. Obviously, Umpqua River, that's a nasty piece of real estate. We used to locally refer to that bar as the Gates of Hell.
100%.
Cape Shoalwater, I saw... You know, a completely different Coast Guard in the Caribbean Theater. A lot of narcotic and migrant interdiction and just a real an eye-opener down there. And then Cape Disappointment. I had always wanted to be there. And a lot of coincidences came into play when I was stationed at the Cape. When I was first out of boot camp, I was sitting in a little restaurant called the Seven Seas, which was an institution in Winchester Bay next to Umpqua River. And I read in Oregon Coast magazine the story of the Triumph and the Mermaid, the 61 disaster. And I thought, poof, you know, those poor people. And little did I know what was in store or held in my fate. And I knew every one of those guys' names. And I had that incident committed to memory. And unfortunately, back then, the Coast Guard, we didn't remember our history as well as we should have. So when I got to the Cape, even then, people didn't know it, and I was just so glad to be there with the Triumph and the lifeboat school attached. And the Cape is another piece of real estate where Umpqua, when it was closed, it was closed. The Cape, you could get across it usually, but it may take you 4 hours. And then going on to the, I really needed a break after the Sea King incident, which I'll return to, and it. I knew who the detailer was, and they actually called me and gave me a choice of some very nice units, and I selected the Elderberry just to take a break from search and rescue and lifeboats for a while. So the Elderberry was a great
tour. I always knew that's the way that it worked. I always knew it.
Well, you know, I didn't know it until I got the call.
Yeah, no matter, right? Yeah, no matter how much people denied it, I always knew that was it.
Yeah, and I'll give him a shout out right now, CWO Wayne Stacy.
There you go.
Great man, he's still out there active in Sea Scouts, hell of a guy. And,
awesome.
He took care of people. He knew who needed what, and, you know, obviously I'd have gone wherever they sent me, but that, I got off the phone, and I was talking to the CO and the chief, and I said, well, they gave me this unit, and this unit, and I got to decide, and they're like, you didn't take the elderberry immediately, and I'm like, well, I told them I'd get back to them. So, needless to say, I was back on the phone in 10 minutes and went up there to Alaska and just great tour. Great tour if anyone has a chance. And Aton from SAR or anywhere else, Aton is a great, great field. So, I learned a lot up there. And then when that tour was done, I had orders to go to lifeboat school. Again, that's a very challenging assignment. I mean, you know, you're going out in that weather with people you don't know, judging how they can run boats or can't run boats, and putting them on the helm when you think they can do it. So those guys do a great job. It's a lot of stress.
Well, Jeff,
and obviously my most memorable tour was the Cape, and unfortunately for the reason of the Sea King disaster. And I can get into that a little bit if you'd like.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So again, I had the 61 disaster committed to memory, and I was looking forward to meeting those people. It took those guys 30 years before they were able to get together again, whoever was left, and come out to the Cape.
So Jeff, just really quick, just if you want to kind of give a brief go over of what the 61 incident was, you keep referring to it.
Yeah, so 1961, the fishing vessel Mermaid with the Bergman brothers on it, called out for assistance, and throughout the course of that rescue, the Coast Guard lost the first 52-footer, all hands on board except for Gordon Huggins. They lost a 40-footer. They lost a 36-footer. The Storrs had gone out. Aircraft went out. So the only survivor was Gordon Huggins off the original Triumph. And just... I owe it to these guys. So again, the Bergman brothers were lost, BM1 John Culp, Petty Officer 2nd John Hoban, Seaman Ralph Mace, Petty Officer 3rd Joseph Petrin, and Seaman Gordon Sussex. And again, the only survivor was Gordon Huggins. So, and that was January 11th, 1961. Mm-hmm. So January 11th, 1991, those survivors were going to come out and meet at the Cape and at the lifeboat score over at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. So I was really looking forward to meeting those people. And an hour before they were supposed to get to the Cape, the Mayday came in from the Sea King.
You're kidding me, dude. On the same date.
The very day.
That is unbelievable.
And it gets even freakier than that. So these people, like I said, took them 30 years to be able to get together again and put that issue to rest. And I'm not so sure that, you know, you can ever put something like that to bed, but
Jeff, can you talk about, before you go in too deep in the Sea King, back to that 61, does that two things, like, did you ever read any, the article that you read? It obviously spoke to you, you know, because it kind of helped you make that decision to join, but what was it about that rescue and that whole event that was kind of, what drew your attention besides the loss of life?
Being at Umpqua River, obviously, anytime someone spoke of, like, the Coast Guard's top gun, it was the Cape and the lifeboat school. And that's where, I think as a boat driver, you aspire to run a boat on the Cape. And I had always wanted to be there. And that story just, for some reason, it stuck with me. And I can't tell you why. So even when I got there, when we would have open house days on the Cape, I would type out what I remembered of that story and who the people were. And I'd put it out on the boat and hand it to guests that came on board. And again, I'm ashamed to say that most people in active duty at the time didn't even realize that.
No, and awesome. Good for you, though, like making that that history sustain.
Well, and then throughout all of it, I became great friends with Gordon Huggins, the only survivor off the first Triumph. And I think he would tell you the same thing if he were still here, God rest him, that him and I talking to each other and just comparing what we'd been through, and obviously he went through something I couldn't even imagine. I mean, he got washed off the boat. The original Triumph capsized, was upside down for a period 6 to 8 minutes. He's guessing when it came up, nobody was on board. Complete darkness. The next set of breakers came in. He's in the water, and he pretty much came to the conclusion he was going to meet his maker. He was giving up when he felt the bottom under him, and a couple guys actually happened to see him bobbing in the water in Peacock Spit, which is probably one of the most violent places imaginable during a bad storm. Not only the waves, you've got logs in there, and how that man made it to shore through Peacock Spit at the height of that storm is just, God truly had a hand in that.
Yeah, that's a miracle in and of itself.
So we got to be very good friends, and were a great comfort to each other while he was still here. And reading his name those many years earlier at Umpqua, and then having gone through the Sea King. So they came out. They were over at the Columbia River Maritime Museum, and they were standing there looking at things and listening to the radio when they heard the disaster unfold in almost the same spot that theirs happened 30 years earlier. 30 years in one day. Theirs was the 11th of January. Mine was the 12th. So it kind of put a lot of them, you know. And back then, and even when my incident, PTSD wasn't a known quality. But a lot of them were just stunned that it had happened again while they were there.
Right.
And so at the start of that day, I was the duty surfman. I knew if anything could come in, we would be taking the Triumph, the 52-footer. The school was out doing some training. When the Sea King called in that they were taking on water, and that just kind of seemed to me as odd because most of the fleet had come in. They knew what was coming. So a lot of them came in. And the school responded and realized it was just more than a 44. Not more than it could handle, but they recognized the 52 was the right platform for it. So we made preparations to get underway. And I will mention this, that for some reason, and I to this day I don't know why, and I've come to peace with things, but somehow the air station inserted itself probably deeper into this than it should have.
Ouch.
I take operational control and be the SAR mission coordinator, and we're calling the shots. So somewhere along the lines, the decision was made to hoist people off and put people on the boat, which I don't know if I'd agreed with at the time, but it was done while I was getting the 52 underway. So by the time I was getting underway, they'd already put a couple people on the boat, tried to take fishermen off when the hoist cable got caught in the mast, the rigging of the ship. Mm-hmm. So they sheared the cable, dropped the fisherman back to the deck 20, 30 feet in a Stokes. So now he was critically injured with a back injury. So that's how MK1 sextant Rudy got put on board to take care of him. Rudy was an EMT. So I want to say at that point we had 4 Coasties on board, 2 from the Cape, 1 out of the helicopter, and Rudy to tend to the injured fisherman. And that may seem abnormal, but it really takes a few people to keep those pumps running under extreme conditions. So I get out there, get it into tow, and it didn't look like we were going to. We took a look at the bar, turned around, realized it was not favorable for a crossing. Somewhere at district level or the group level, the 180 was sent out, the Iris. And the skipper of the Iris had a radio voice that you heard it once, you'd never forget it. And
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It was a good thing.
Okay, all right.
He really had a very confident voice. He was a great ship driver, and I actually became very good friends with him in the civilian side. I worked for him in the 911 field for many years before he retired, and I took over his position. Commander Dick Lang, great ship driver, very smart man. So the Iris is out there, and now the Iris is on-scene commander. And again, you know, normal times we would have sent the 52. The 52 would have been both it's our mission and unseen unless something extraordinary happened, just like we'd done hundreds of times before. So now I've got the Iris out there with me. The 47200, the prototype project, was also out there with the test team that was on there. And another good group of guys, a lot of experience. So I get it into tow. We take a look at the bar. It's not looking good. So we turn around, and worst case scenario, I'm thinking we're going to be out here all night. So the Iris, I thought, great. They can at least do the navigation for us. They can, you know, we'll just do a slow racetrack out here. They can keep an eye on where everybody is. And because if you ever tried to plot on a chart in a 52 or a 44 in bad weather, it's not a pretty sight.
Even in good weather, it sucks.
Yeah, it does. And we didn't have chart plotters or anything else. So you're down there looking at, you know, magenta and green Loran lines, trying to fit the little interpolator between there and not get sick and throw up on everything. So it was nice to have them. And I thought, you know what, they can keep track of us all night. And then again, the decision was made. We started easing in, and a fishing vessel by the name of the, I believe it was the Steve C, was ahead of us, was crossing. And we start coming across slow. I've got the Iris behind me and the 47 behind me. And, you know, by this time, I want to say the tow was behind me, the Sea King, 1,000 feet. We had just about every piece of, I want to say it's either 4 or 5 inch on the 52. I don't recall now. And I want to say we carried 1,200 feet of it. So it's a long way back.
Yeah, you're out there. Yeah.
And my last reports were everything were dry and the pumps were secure. And it was his boat was actually running. So he was clutched in helping us with the tow. So things were going good. And I thought, you know, another couple hours, we got it in the bag, just like every other time. So as we start coming in, we saw some steep waves, and the Steve C said that's the worst you're going to see, was ahead of me still maybe a mile. So we proceeded in slowly. And last thing I remember is the captain, for some reason on the Sea King, said he was going to bring his engines up a little bit. My immediate concern was I didn't want him overtaking the tow line. So I told him that was fine, just very little and very slowly, so I could keep an eye on him and increase my speed if I needed to. And again, he was only going to help get us across the bar. So I was keeping an eye on that. And then the very next thing I hear is we're getting off this. I turn around and it's over 60 degrees. And I was just, it's one of those moments that your mind sees what it sees, but you can't comprehend it. So my crew immediately wanted to cut the tow line. I stopped them from doing that, and the Triumph carried maybe 6 or 8, I want to say 75, 80-inch ball fenders, big ones. I had them tow that or tie those on to the tow line. I wanted it marked. I thought with enough boats and ships running around here, we don't want anyone sucking up this 5-inch double braid. So, and I thought if we could mark it, if worst case scenario, we knew where it was. So we got all those fenders tied on. And then I actually took my survival knife out, and the tow line was under such tension, I just laid it on it, and it was just like a knife through hot butter. It was gone. So we turned around, and by that time, the 47 had picked up one or two people. Again, just mass confusion, because obviously with the current and everything, everything was moving towards Peacock Spit. So we were trying to get a head count, who was there, who wasn't there, who the 47 had, who we were missing. My chief, Guy Weston, at that time, then got underway with the other 44. The school boats were still out there. The drift was taking it into Peacock's Bit, which, again, is the worst possible area you could be in a storm like that. So we get onto the edge of Peacock and looking around, and the boat's not turning like it should. And I thought we'd lost an engine. So we got to a safest spot as we could, broke watertight integrity. My engineer, Rich Vermillion, went down. Everything was running fine, but we knew something was wrong. So we were actually at that point ordered out of the surf and to return. So we got in, they pulled the boat as soon as we did. And we wound up with, 800 square feet of net patch wrapped around one of the wheels. So the wheel was actually a big round ball of fishing net and just was not getting any bite on it. So that's why the performance, we couldn't turn. We had no propulsion on one side. And that's when I learned who we had lost. And it was like a nightmare.
What okay. did they, when they told you, Jeff, did you, I'm just trying to imagine at the station, was it like launch all the boats, launch all the aircraft?
Yes.
Yes.
And unfortunately, if I remember right, but memory is a funny thing. And I didn't realize this until I got into the police side of things. And you go through a critical incident and you think you know what happened. And then you watch your actual, your body cam or your police vehicle footage. And okay. I was just stunned at things that I thought had happened or where I'd been. And I wasn't. So I'll just throw that out there as a disclaimer.
Perspective is an amazing, amazing thing.
So when we got back, the aircraft that sheared the cable had to do an emergency landing at the Cape. And I met that guy later. He was the district commander, an admiral. And they thought they were going to lose the aircraft. Because when they sheared it, it went up and hit the main rotor. And I'm not an aviator, but it gave them some kind of main rotor shake that scared the heck out of those guys. So they did emergency landing at the Cape. And I didn't know that either. So they had to bring other aircraft in to start searching, and I'm not so sure we didn't have a C-130 at one point. But my day was done at that point. I was just stunned, in shock, numb.
Did they get the Triumph back out there?
Yes, later that night. They pulled it, got the net out, and it went back out with another crew.
Yeah. How long did that search go on?
I want to say most of the night, if not all night. And then I'd hesitate to even say I know they got Sexton that night. They brought him in. Chief Weston on the Capes 44 found him in Peacock's Spit. So they were doing CPR shortly after I got in. The 47 had brought in one or two of the fishermen. So I think at that point we were still missing one person. It might have been the skipper. So the search went well into the night, if not all night.
Yeah. What happened the next day?
And this is another thing that nobody really prepares you for. And I get why it occurs, but I'm almost hesitant to say it. But the next thing is you get attorneys. And I'll just leave it there. But
yeah, no, I get
back,
it.
That incident, it cost me a great deal of health. I mean, the pressure afterwards and what was going on. And I mean, I had full support of my CO who retired as Admiral Neptune. Great guy.
Awesome.
I had a great group of people around me. And just going through that whole process. I understand why it's done. But a little daunting when you're in the hot seat for all that. And I don't remember talking to the NTSB. I remember talking to Coast Guard investigators, safety board. I think at one point the ship's owners had representatives there. So, in my mind, I knew, there was nothing I'd have done differently. Knowing what I know now, of course, I would do a few things different, but that was just the standard way we did things. I mean, we didn't take everybody off ships and tow them across empty or boats or, we just didn't do that. And we rarely helicoptered anybody on. So took me years to put that all to bed. And I'll tell you what, one of the greatest things that helped me do that was meeting Gordon Huggins, the survivor of the 61 disaster.
Right.
And so that was delayed a little bit, but I finally did get to meet him. And again, we got to be great friends. And then the two of us started the memorial that's still going strong. So the first memorial service we had out there was just him and I. We went out on the Triumph, put a wreath in the water. And last year would have been 50th for the 61 disaster, I believe. Wow. Which unfortunately, due to COVID, we had to do via videotape. But prior to that, I mean, it was well attended by almost 200 people. It had grown in size and stature, and really was really a great thing to do. And not only for the people on those two incidents, but everyone in the Northwest and the Coast Guard on the West Coast, we honored all of them that had given a full measure and didn't come home.
Right.
100%. And again, like, good on you guys for maintaining that history and that, that honor, the sacrifices that were made.
Right.
Last year was the first year we did it without Gordon, and I will, you know, even though I'm moving to Texas, I will be back every year for the January Memorial.
Awesome.
That's awesome. That's a good legacy to have, Jeff.
It is, and the Cape and the Columbia River Maritime Museum and all the institutions around there are fully supportive of it, and it's become quite an ordeal to do every year, and it's something I'm very proud of.
Well, and Jeff, you said, you know, Gordon helped you, and I'm assuming, you know, this is just full on assumption, but Gordon being the sole survivor, they always talk about survivor's guilt and, you know, just that, you know, I made it, nobody else did kind of thing.
Well, yeah. And you're talking a guy in a foul weather coat and a pair of dungarees.
Right.
So that's how rudimentary things were back then. And, after my accident, I was given Pepto-Bismol and told to get over it.
Yeah.
Well, what did Gordon say to you that helped, other than just like talk it out? You know, what did he say anything specific?
Well, I think we came to a mutual understanding of we were both under some form of PTSD and the things we'd experienced, and the issues we had health-wise were very similar, and finally, he was able, and after I had sought out help through the VA, he went back to the VA and got his claim going and got help. And so it became very, very cathartic to the two of us.
Awesome. And sometimes it's not even about having to say anything. It's just having someone that has that shared experience that you can sit in a room just quiet with. I know, having gone through something,
you're exactly right.
Really helps. Yeah.
Because if either one of us had said a word, that right. would have done the same thing, just sitting in there. And Monty Markham, a Hollywood producer and actor, was doing a series called The Great Ships, mm-hmm. telling stories. And that's, we originally got together to film an episode of, I think, the 61 and the 91 incident. And that's how the first time we actually got together, although we had planned on it. And that became another very healing moment for the two of us to be able to talk through what happened. And again, you know, books have been written, articles have been written, people have come to final conclusions, and at some point, you know, you have to let it all go,
right,
and get on with your life. And that's easier said than done, I'll tell you.
Right.
But you get to that position or your point in life, and you get on with the next thing. And I remember the next call I had is the surfman crossing a bad barb. I was a little hesitant, wondering, you know, is this my career calling? And
I'm sure you second guess every decision after that, you know, after that. Am I doing the right thing?
We were a little gun shy around the Cape after that but you know, life goes on. We also included the family and relatives of the fishermen that have been lost over time at the memorial service. We don't forget them, because right. I mean, they're out there really putting their lives on the line, doing a dangerous job.
Right.
So
we don't call it, they had to go out for nothing.
That's right. So, and I've made some great friendships through some of those relatives and family members of the people that we had lost that were civilians. And, so then that brought me, I had the choice to go up to the Elderberry, which I did, enjoyed it, and then came back down to the lifeboat school. And I'll just mention this briefly, but I think that's the culmination of when the health effects of what happened were really catching up to me.
Right.
Well, Jeff, by that time, were they, I mean, so, you know, anybody, I didn't really like throw it out there on the intro, but anybody that served time in the Coast Guard post September 11th or, you know, post 91, I guess, probably knows the Sea King, knows of the case, because they've done it and reviewed it for every risk assessment training that they've probably ever been to. So by the time you got back to the lifeboat school, was it the same? Like, was it already becoming a case study and things changing, or was it still too new?
No, so to the Coast Guard's credit, let me back it up a little bit. When I first got to the Cape, the Coast Guard was just introducing something called TCT, which was team coordination training, to stop accidents before they start. And then the name changed several times, but at the time in the lifeboat school, when I got there, we were actually teaching that. We had a class, and I forget what we entitled the class, but we were using case studies and talking to students about, you need to be ready for, because when, it'll happen when you least expect it, and it won't be anything like you were prepared for.
Yep.
So, yeah, there was team coordination training, and then actually it came in as HART, Human Error Accident Reduction Training, was the first version of it. So
I like HART better than TCT. That sounds cooler than TCT in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. And, they took, pilots have used checklists for years, and there's a reason for that. The same with operating rooms. So, again, the Coast Guard was on the forefront of that, and I know just from my training, and I was heavily steeped in it. I'd been to several classes and trained in it, and it prevented several accidents on calls I was involved in, just because, I actually took a moment and looked around and thought, what are we doing?
Right.
Yeah.
And, recognized, hey, the shore tie's not off. Maybe we ought to unconnect the shore tie before we pull away. Maybe we ought to put the 28-foot mast up before we go into the 14-foot boathouse. I mean, it's just stuff like that. And, people get anxious. They hear that SAR alarm or any other call where people's lives are at risk. And it's easy to overlook small details that if you stop them before they get started, your outcomes are usually much better.
Right. And if there's options on how to respond, all it takes is one idea and then somebody going, yeah, and then we're screwed. You know what I mean? Like, oh, that was a bad idea. We shouldn't have done that one.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And, again, it goes back, it probably came out of aviation, but when I first started in the Coast Guard, you didn't dare say anything to the guy driving the boat. I mean, that wasn't your place. Your place was to do what you were told. And by the time I had gone several years with the team coordination and HART training, I mean, and good for us, we had, the seamen, the firemen, the engineer, they were watching the drift of the boat, where crab pots were, where obstacles were. I mean, stuff that really took a lot off the coxswain's plate.
Yeah.
Because you can reach task saturation very quickly in heavy weather. And the more people that know the mission, what's important, what's happening, the parameters of the mission, what the dangers are, the better off you are.
Right. No, that's good. So you said you were kind of at the forefront of it. I'm guessing you took some of those lessons learned or whatever to kind of the curriculum you guys are instructing them up there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, and then one of them that sticks out in my mind is when I was up in Alaska. The buoy tender didn't want to go put a very critical aid back on station. So somehow we hired a commercial vessel to pull a buoy back onto station and put a quartermaster from a patrol boat on with a sextant. There's an old saying, if you're going to pound the nail, you use a hammer. If you're going to move a buoy, you use a buoy tender. So things went horribly wrong on that case, and we got sent out to assist. And when I got out there, I was like, we're not doing anything. This is crazy. We're done. Everything's done. I mean, it was just so fraught with danger and peril that I knew. And that.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
First of all, there are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
And these exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum. And here's our favorite 5.
For as little as $5 a month, you can become a plank owner and support the construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
You know, I didn't blindly go out there and do what I was told. I went out there and assessed the situation, and, you know, 12 knots of current, trying to move a buoy with a sinker that we didn't know the condition of, and, I mean, just and not on a buoy tender, I put an end to it.
What buoy was it?
One of the entrance buoys to Wrangell Narrows.
Yeah, I was just trying to picture it. I'm going to have to look it up on a chart now.
And I'm pretty sure that made it into Guido's.
Yeah. Well, I figure if the, you know, if the surfman on the Sea King is telling me that moving this buoy was sketchy, then man, that is a sketchy buoy up there. There's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, we lost a few thousand dollar handheld radio and a sextant.
Yeah.
Rather than somebody's life, which is where this was headed to.
Right. So, Jeff, I have questions, and I know this was part of your intro, but I want to talk about your time in Florida and doing just drug interdiction stuff. I know during that time, it was a pretty heavy time getting a lot of drugs, doing drug interdiction through Cuba and Florida. So I kind of want to steer that way and kind of get some info about your time in Florida. So can you kind of walk us through when you first got there?
Yeah, unfortunately, the highlight of that, just like when people say, you know, in the old guard, well, unfortunately, the old guard ended one day before you came in, was the old joke.
Always.
The highlight of those drug busts had kind of ended before I got there, but we still did, I want to say we had 4 or 5 seizures in my time there, which was less than 2 years, and probably the most famous one. We were the first test case to seize under zero tolerance policy that President, I believe, Bush had enabled. Mm-hmm. So we seized a fast boat coming across from the banks. We're in pursuit for quite a while before we finally were able to get it stopped. And that was the test case for the zero tolerance. And it withstood a federal lawsuit. And then the other one that sticks out of my mind, and this may be dating myself, but if you remember back years ago when Gary Hart was running for president and he got caught with a certain Guess jeans model on a boat, we wound up seizing that very boat.
Wow.
And that very boat still had life-size cutouts of the Guess jeans model. So, you know, it just, it was something. And then, you know, to see people that risk their lives to try and get over to the U.S. just to live a better life. It's some of the boats and conditions, just it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Talk to me about that, only because I know obviously right now in history, we're dealing with a lot of, you know, stuff, a lot of political issues in Cuba. And I know a lot of people are kind of confused as to why we've got an open border.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's above my pay grade, but, you know, the people that I saw risk their lives and what they came over on, and I'm sure it often happens that they don't make it, and we wind up picking up pieces of it, but a couple of them I'd been on, we knew they were not seaworthy vessels, and the longer we were on them, everybody's life was in danger. I mean, just in a 2 to 4 foot swell, the pilot house is moving 6-8 inches every time the boat rolls, and, live chickens on deck and other barn creatures that they were using to sustain themselves, and just horrendous, horrendous conditions that these people were willing to undertake to get to the United States. So the humanitarian part of that, I felt great that we were able to get them safely off that, whatever they were on. And sometimes it was rafts before they capsized or the thing just broke apart on them. And they would have had no chance of making it, no life jackets, you know, no equipment like you would picture on a boat that you or I would go out in. And again, they're risking everything for the freedom and chances in the United States. So making sure they got somewhere safely was, you know, you felt good that you were doing your job.
And was that was wet foot, dry foot a thing back then? It should have been, right? I think you're around that time. So if they made it, they were in. If they didn't, they went back.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
And so when we got everybody on board and made them as comfortable as we could, and when we would dock up in Miami, we would just turn them over to Immigrations and Customs. So from there, where they went, I don't know. But I know they didn't drown that day.
Yeah, for sure. Did you guys do Haitians too, or was it just Cubans?
I want to say it was Haitians on the one boat I'm specifically thinking of, but we were always on either the Little Bahama Banks or the Grand Bahama Banks, and worked in conjunction. There was another operation called OPBAT, I think, Operation Bahamians and Turks, for migrant and drug interdiction throughout that area. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it cool being stationed in the Caribbean? It's like anything weird that could happen is going to happen down here. That's the way I always feel. It's kind of like that. If you saw the assassination attempt in Haiti that just happened, I was like, yeah, I'm not surprised. It's the Caribbean.
It's what happens. You're right. You're right. And, you know, it's just when you pull into a place like the Bahamas, you don't wander the island to look for tourist stuff to do. You just don't.
Yeah, you stay in the tourist area.
You're not in your Coast Guard uniform and just hanging out on the islands? That's not a thing?
Yeah. Yeah, imagine that. So that was kind of an eye-opener to me as well.
Well, Jeff, right. did you ever take it down to Puerto Rico? Did you guys ever sail that far?
No.
I was just curious. Nope. Yeah, we had a guest on the other day who, you ever heard the town La Perla?
Yes.
Yeah, of course you have. You know what this guy's telling us? He's like, yeah, I was walking around La Perla, and, you know, the FBI came up and was like, what the hell are you doing out here? Everybody knows. Yeah. You guys even knew back in the 80s, like, don't go to La Perla, and it's sustained to 2021.
Yeah, so we would pull in, and we were told you can go around in the daylight in twos, but stay where the cruise ships moor up.
Yep.
Nobody, you couldn't walk anywhere at night. You had to get in a cab, and again, be in twos, and they strongly discouraged that. So, yeah, it was an eye-opener.
Where'd you live down there? Were you guys, you were home port, you said West Palm, so did you live in West Palm Beach?
Yeah, so I lived in Riviera Beach.
Okay.
Nice. And the cutter was tied up in West Palm. And that was the other funny thing down there, because there was a power station, so the manatees would come in and calve and have their babies in the wintertime around the warm water outlets of the power station. So during that time, we would have to go over to Peanut Island, which was the old bomb shelter for the Kennedy family. Kennedy's compound was just across on the Atlantic side of the Intercoastal. Peanut Island was kind of his bomb shelter and probably bunker, so we would tie up there, and you'd have to take a Liberty boat back and forth, which was kind of a pain in the butt. And stranded on an island.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you got to remember the Kennedys, they got their money through rum running anyway. So that's sounds like a perfect perfect home base for all kinds of things. You know, whether it's a bunker or storage point, jump off point, whatever. That's good.
It was an interesting tour, and then that became, I believe, the first 95 footer that the Coast Guard turned over to the Bahamian government. Oh, okay. And they were going to refurbish it and use it for their own purposes over there.
When you may be, I don't know if you're the first 95 sailor that we've had on, but definitely one of few. Could you talk about the platform?
Yeah, again, they were probably all a little bit different, but I just remember we had air starters. Just the sound of those air starters going off and then the engines turning, you knew you had a power plant there. And then we had this electrician's mate that was kind of a mad scientist. He had us a blue light that you'd almost feel the static charge building up and your hair standing on end before this thing pulsed. You could hear it up on the mast just charging up energy and then letting loose with the flash. So I don't know where he got this blue light, but those are the two of the things I remember, in addition to, I almost want to say, 90-some marijuana leaves painted on the stack.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
the 95s, they were a good platform. I remember an 82 tying up right next to us, and I'm sitting on the bridge of the 95 looking across at the 82, and I'm looking at the guy standing on that bridge's feet. So they're another 10 foot above you. So I know the 82s, they were very snappy in any kind of seas. The 95s, they rode pretty good. Unfortunately, they were very tired. So we had parameters. We couldn't be out in anything over 10 foot. So a few times hurricanes had chased us back in.
You guys didn't tell them, like, the safest place for a boat is at sea in a hurricane, and then just, like, head out into it? Never happened, huh?
Well, yeah, so we actually, I forget the name of the hurricane coming in, we beat back from the Bahamas into Miami. And at the time, the 110s were the shiny new toys. And we would pull in with whatever it was, 90, 95 dope leaves, 98 dope leaves on our stack, and look at these 110s with, you know, one or two brand new dope stickers on theirs, and, you know, kind of thumb our nose at them. So we're tying up, doubling the lines, think we're going to ride the hurricane out in Miami, when we're told, no, there's no room, the 110s are taking your spot.
Oh, man,
so.
Dirt, that's dirty. That's
so
dirty.
Out we went, and I still have vivid memories. The cook had served American chop suey, which...
Bad call.
Oh, I think our chief engineer was the only one in any capability without being seasick to stand at the helm and run us back up to West Palm. So it was a trip, but I just remember everyone hanging out the bridge wings, getting sick, and these just towering teal blue waves coming off of our stern. Just, well, you know what the water looks like in the Caribbean, just this turquoise blue, but I've never seen waves this big. And we got in, thankfully, but thank God our chief engineer had an iron stomach.
What, Jeff, you're one of those surfmen that did tours on both coasts, which is kind of rare, right? Like, once you get over, you're a West Coast bred surfman who came to the East Coast for a tour. What did you think of the East Coast once you got there, like, versus the West?
I don't want to say it was different Coast Guards, but at Umpqua River, you could set your watch by what happened at that station on any day of the week. When I got to Florida, Florida was still kind of the Wild West. I think the Coast Guard had just gone through the Isla Mirada scandal.
What was the Isla Mirada scandal? I don't know the Isla Mirada scandal.
Oh, yes.
Sure. We had some Coasties that were selling patrol schedules and other things and doing things they shouldn't have been. And base Miami Beach, different place than Group Astoria, let's put it that way.
Indeed.
Yes, it is. That's funny.
Scandals on scandals.
What about the water? What do you think? You know, you went from like those 30-second periods to like just wind-driven chop everywhere.
Usually, you know, it seemed to me that the water really, especially the Gulf Stream, got really nasty when a cold front came through.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically like a river just offshore in the ocean. And when a storm front or a cold front came through, that current got horrendous. So we were just hoping to be on one side or the other if that ever occurred.
Just don't be in the middle.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, 2-3 hours to cross that is something else. And again, I mean, they were concerned with the structural capabilities of the 95s. They've been around so long, so not being out in anything over 10 foot is a little dicey.
Did they ever try to chop the back off and make it like 123 feet?
No. And I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah, just throwing it out there. They tried that with the 110s. No. I don't think it worked very well.
No. And, you know, in their heyday, fantastic boat.
Yeah.
Great design, great power plants, just a good boat. A little, you know, probably slow for compared to the 110s, but the 110s, I mean, they seem to come and go pretty quick as well.
What was its top speed?
The 95s outlasted them. I want to say we could do 16, 18 knots, maybe.
Yeah.
I would like to say that the 95s are a lot like myself, large and tired, but...
Oh, Gina. You know? Now everybody's like, oh, yeah.
The other thing I remember, though, is as soon as you're underway from the first boarding on, you're constantly wet.
Oh, well.
It just, with the humidity, and you know, the AC works some of the time, and
oh, that'd be brutal, man. No AC. Oh, I don't know what an FRC crew would. They pull it back in. We're done.
Yeah. Well, when I got on one of those 110s and saw the crew berthing, I was stunned because our AC actually drew its air across the great water tank, so you got those nice smells coming out at a frosty 78 degrees. Keeping aft berthing cold, and then we had a slight bend in the starboard shaft, which was where my bunk was over, so loud. Oof.
Have you been on an FRC yet? Did you get to step on one out there on the...
I have been.
Yeah, yep. I mean, what do you think of that compared
to... One of the 87s as well. The 110s were just... They blew me away when I saw what was in a 110.
Yeah.
And you know, that's good. That was long needed in the Coast Guard.
For sure.
Luxury, right? Quite a step up from what you were
used
to.
You're not kidding.
Well, Jeff,
you're not kidding.
Let's take it to your first... what was your first case when you got to Umpqua River? You remember?
Yeah, I do remember. It was a boat by the name of the White Dolphin. I was just a know-nothing seaman wandering around, not knowing what to do, not even knowing who the chief was. When I got to Umpqua River, I want to say I was the 14th man there. We had 3 44-footers, a 30-footer, a 25-footer, and a 16-foot Zodiac.
With only 14 people assigned?
Yep.
Heck yeah, man. That is a fleet to get take advantage of. I love it.
It is, and I still remember seeing the crew pull together, and the White Dolphin was, I want to say it came in on its own power, but fast, and hit our dock and crashed, and somebody on board was having a heart attack, and I just thought, man, this... I'm going to love this.
Right. That's awesome. Yes. Good.
And then I think my first tour as a coxswain, and I worked for some very sharp people, and they knew when it was time to kick people out of the nest. At the time, I didn't realize that, but I was out on a very snotty bar thinking this should be a surfman, but I went out and got the boat in tow, got it in, and I was just coming across the tip. I had timed the set, coming across the tip, and the bit on the fishing vessel's bow failed and snapped.
Of course it did.
So right at the mouth of the river, we wound up, and then he starts his engine and comes in under his own power, which I didn't know he had any power at the time, but that one sticks out in my mind. And then discussing that with the master chief as to what happened and, you know, what I was thinking and what I was doing. And I felt complete confidence in myself, but it just, that's when you know that, you know, you've made the right choice. And I, so many good mentors, and, you know, not only in the bosun field, a lot of engineers. I learned a lot from MKs, DCs, electricians, a lot of good people.
Yeah, very good to throw that out there. What was your coxswain check ride like?
I failed the first one.
All right, that's fair. That happens.
Had another small chat with the master chief and had set yoke on his door.
Do you remember what'd you do wrong? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was passing the pump down the tow line. I was going too fast.
Oh, okay.
And it was something I'd done 100 times. I don't know why, but on that day I flubbed it. So I told him I wanted to do 7 more. I don't know where I came up with 7, but I said I want to do 7 more drills like that, and then do another check ride, and nailed the next one. But he, you know, even as a seaman, I remember being in the master chief's office studying Navrals with the BM1 who couldn't pass them, and I had already aced it as a seaman or seaman apprentice, and I was scared to death to be in there. I didn't know why I was in there. I'm in there going over Navrals with the master chief and a BM1 who couldn't pass the test to save his life, and then I did the deck watch officer as a seaman. And my second coxswain check ride, I knew that type manual front cover to back cover, and finally the mesh chief just opened the window and threw it out. There was not a question he couldn't answer me, or I couldn't answer for him, that, you know, didn't have height, width, weight, whatever.
Awesome.
So I made sure I knew everything, and the next check ride went great. And we had a mesh chief at that time that you knew somewhere in your check ride you were going to be pulling him out of the water. He would bail.
Yeah, that used to be a thing. I remember that, man, all the time. Like, people just randomly jump off. Yep.
You have a tow on or something, you know the mast chief's going in the water somewhere, so just be ready.
Well, and that's a stressful recovery, because, I mean, that's the boss of the boss.
It is.
Know, like, that's the guy, and you're driving right on him to recover him, so it's, yeah, I feel
Yeah, the
I
only good it. Thing about that is, if you don't get him back, you know you failed your check ride.
Yeah, true that. Yeah, you got your answer, huh?
No questions about it, yeah. So the next one, I
Gina,
yeah,
Gina's
I ate,
like, bosom may humor. That's what she did. She's rolling her eyes. Hardy, har, har. You shut it. Oh, sorry. So the next check ride.
By the time I had left Umpqua, I want to say we were almost 50 people.
Oh, wow.
The station, and it had gone through its remodel, and the old station really was needing a remodel, and we got a haul out facility, and a lot of good stuff came out of that. And I was there almost 5.5 years, so from seaman apprentice to BM2, and I struck. I did everything right there. I didn't go to school. I just took my courses out, studied. And
did you make surfman before you left?
No, heavy weather.
Yeah. And then when
there was three syllabuses.
When did you make
coxswain,
surfman?
Heavy weather, then surfman. At the Cape.
How? Well, talk to us about it. So the Coast Guard right now, clue you in. There's a deficit of surfmen. So they're constantly recruiting, right? So, like, anything you can say to make that job sound cooler than we all know it is. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Hit it. Now's your chance.
Well, you know, when I started, surfman was specifically a Pacific Northwest thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, you didn't have the East Coast surfman, huh?
You know, not that I'm aware of, and then I could be wrong, but at the time, the lifeboat school was regional, not national.
Yeah,
it was a Pacific Northwest school for Oregon, Washington, and maybe a station in Northern California, but it was a regional school. Specifically for the lifeboat stations on Oregon, Washington coast.
Yeah.
And then for some, I don't want to say comic relief, but for some lighter attitudes, we also brought they brought Canadians in quite a bit through the school. And let me just say, those boys know how to party.
I believe it.
With their Labatt Blue. Their Molson Ice. Their Labatt Blue.
And then when it became a national school with the standardization team, that's when the Coast Guard really started reaching out across the country, east and west coast, with the stand team going out, seeing what's going on with these boats. And, you know, the whole idea for the school was these boats could far surpass what the crews were currently trained to do.
So yeah, 100%.
That brought the level of training and standards up on those boats. And we would, as part of the school, we would augment the stand team, which was a separate division of the school. The bosun mate instructors would plug in and out of that, and we'd travel all over the country and do inspections and drills and see what was going on out there, which was a good program, much needed.
When I'm with them and with you, I'd say I've never felt in danger being on a 47 motor lifeboat. I can't say that about every platform of the Coast Guard, but in general, most of them feel pretty safe, and like you're pretty confident they'll get you home.
Yeah, and it's nice to know that, you know, you go from 147 or 144 to the other, the gear is going to be in the same place, things are going to be set up the same.
For sure.
And even boat to boat, I mean, it's like Umpqua, three boats, you don't want, you know, sidelines kept in one place on one boat and another place on another boat. And so, yeah, standardization. And when we first started, I was amazed at what was actually out in the field.
You know what would be cool, though, is if there needs to be like one designated compartment that's just like the random gear that you want for that unit. That's all they need. They just one compartment. And then at least you know where it's at, right? Like, there's all the random gear that nobody else has.
And that used to be the cubby hole. That was the cubby hole right down on the mess deck. Yep.
All right, there you go.
You put whatever you wanted in there as long as the ship's bell was in there. That was, I think, the only checkoff item we had.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at those times, a 50-mile call on a 44 was considered extraordinarily long. And when I first got out, I went to a company. It was a defense contractor with some alphabet soup name. And we wound up transferring 44s to Honduras. I thought, that's kind of cool. You're going to put them on a ship, a plane? How you get them there? And they're like, no, we're going to put them together in Key West and sail them.
Nice.
And
were you like, I volunteer, you know, I'm going?
I was a little skeptical at first, but I went over and we went, not sure where on the East Coast, there were several laid up in a boatyard. So we took a look at them, took them apart, put them on flatbed, shipped them to Key West, and put two of them back together and actually sailed them from Key West all the way to Honduras. And
that had to have been a fun trip. Yeah, for sure.
What a trip.
Where'd you guys stop on the way down?
We did not stop.
Oh, okay. Maybe not.
You know, it got a little. It got a little scary once we got off the, you know, 3 miles out, and the U.S. flag came down, and Honduran flag went up, and they're starting to change course closer to Cuba because they have good relations with Cuba.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that may be so, but you still have American citizens on board, so let's just swing that a little bit over to the right there, pal.
We're not stopping in Havana today, guys.
No, we are not. So, yeah, and, you know, after those boats were laid up, we put them back together. And, I mean, they were gas-axed apart, and we threw everything back together, swung the compasses, and probably 2,400, which is max RPM from the time we left the buoy till the time we pulled into Honduras 4 days later, and we might have slowed down once to top up on oil.
Dude, that's a bold move right there, driving it like that.
They just ran and ran and ran, and, yeah. I was surprised.
Hey, Jeff,
we had to get off it by the time we got into Honduras.
A quick pop quiz. What's that bell for? You said the bell.
If you're at anchor or something else.
Man, you're good. Look at you. You are an old boatswain mate. I love it. Good man.
Yeah.
I bet if we would have had Gina, would have no idea.
The 44s had, twin anchors and a fire station on them.
Yeah. Well, so give us, you know, like we said, there's a deficit in surfmen. So any pitch you could have for somebody coming up that might be interested in that world of work that you committed your life to, what would you say to encourage, I guess? Or maybe to scare them away.
Well, I just, you know, if you're not the kind of person that likes to mentor and train others, then it's probably not for you. But the surfmen, I owe a great debt to the people that came before me, and hopefully I left some in better position, but it really is. You are a trainer foremost and first.
100%.
That is the only way the Coast Guard can operate in the conditions they do in those boats, is people being fully trained and having the confidence in their skills and the abilities of the boat. So, yeah, it's
as a dedication. Yeah, so as an aviator, the surfman is supposed to be what, the elite of the boat force? That's usually what
small boats, yes.
Okay.
And, you know, the most, not only surfmen, but it tends to be Coast Guard coxswains in general.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even during the World Wars, the Coast Guard coxswains operating for the Navy were some of the best small boat handlers there were.
Takes a bunch of lawless people to go
Douglas
out there and
Monroe.
Make it happen. Yeah.
Douglas
Monroe is a great example.
There it is. Hashtag Douglas Monroe.
That's
there
right.
There he is. Yeah.
You know, you're kind of modest about it too, because the when you talk about training, right? This isn't like classroom training. If you never train somebody to drive, to crew, but especially drive a boat in foul weather, especially. It is a white knuckle event, I would say, for the most part, until you kind of settle into a rhythm. But it's definitely something that takes a lot of getting used to, and I can only imagine trying to do it at Peacock Spit.
You know, it twice in my career did I get over that, and the first time was I went through the lifeboat school when it was a regional school, so I was at three and a half weeks, and we wound up having more surf time than any other class they'd put through it. Halfway through that class, I didn't feel like I was having a heart attack. I knew I reached that plateau, that I was at ease, at comfort with the boat, the driver, the conditions, my own capabilities. And then, I ran into that same phenomenon when, as an instructor, when you're putting others on the helm. That's very tense to put somebody on the helm to operate in those conditions, even though you're right there and they say, yeah, you can grab it and take over. Well, I've seen a lot of boats roll where you can't get control of it fast enough.
Yeah.
So you get to that level again of skill and judgment and not that the fear ever goes away, and it never should. I mean, you've got to have a healthy respect. You're never going to beat Mother Nature.
Right.
And, you know, over the years, when I've seen some of those boats come back from rollovers or just extreme accidents, oof.
And I would encourage the listeners that have no idea what we're talking about, if you get on YouTube and look up the United States Coast Guard Surfman School, it'll go through a video and show you exactly just how arduous and how just in your face it really is. And it's just it's a pretty awesome thing, and definitely something that I would say is elite, so...
And you know, the other thing I will mention, I'm very sad to see the 44 or the 52s go.
Right. Yeah, but hey, we haven't seen the replacement yet, though, Jeff. It could be like, it might be something way cooler that we never even imagined. You know, the 110 to that 95 or the FRC to the 95.
You want Jeff's prediction?
Hey, only yes. If it's positive. It's got to be positive.
The replacement is the slept 47.
You stop it. Okay. All right. Come on, Jeff. Come on, don't put that evil on them. I think they're going to pull it off. I think there's going to be something.
I saw one of the first 47s go through the SLEP program, and it somebody did some things right on that boat.
Yeah, I haven't seen the full SLEP. The only thing you always hope is that they don't over-engineer a boat that's going to do what those boats are going to do, you know?
Yeah.
ECM kill the engine all the time because some electronics tripped offline.
I think we won that battle.
Yeah.
And no, it's, I'm excited. Again, you know, it's listening to the men and women that operate these boats at the edge of the envelope that you're right. If we need to go from forward to reverse, we don't need 10 seconds of delay.
Right.
It's done for an emergency reason. It's not something you do every day, and it's same with splitting throttles or any of the other maneuvers. But yeah, it's we'll see. It's a sad day for the 52s to be laid up.
Till they put one in the Columbia River Maritime Museum, and then everybody's going to be excited.
I'm hoping that's where she's going.
Yeah, you get that big diorama in there. That thing's going to be awesome.
Get a little plug for the old Maritime Museum.
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
Yeah. Well, the 300s in there. That was. I was the instructor on that boat for many years. And then the Peacock is sitting in the parking lot on a nice display, the bar pilot ship. So if the 52, the Triumph belongs there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. If you guys haven't ever visited the Columbia River Maritime Museum, it's definitely, it's something to witness. It's pretty cool. Great. Hey, Jeff, did you ever roll one?
No. Thought I was going over a few times, and I want to say I've been past 90.
Yeah. Got your hair wet.
And lo and behold, yeah, my hair and a lot of other things. Lo and behold, it came back up.
Yeah, good.
I have felt that sickening feeling, though, where at 8 or 10 knots, you feel the strength of the wave just stop you dead in your tracks, and the whole thing shakes. And I've seen those windows punched out, and wow, not something you want to do.
Yeah, for sure.
No, so crews come in, and you know, a couple hundred stitches later, the windows are put back together.
It is real eerie, like you talked about. You know, it's funny in the surf. The videos make it all look pretty fast, I think, right? Like everything happens very fast. But you know, once you square up to the wave, really, you're just putting a little bit of power on to be able to punch through and over.
That's
and
right.
If it catches you wrong though, and you start that that move to 90 and beyond, you're right. It's an eerie feeling.
The 47 inherent in its design had that dead spot where it fell from like whatever 15 degrees over to 35 or whatever it was, to where there was no riding arm moment, but it stopped.
Right.
That was kind of freaky the first few times, and you know the Coast Guard's had other boats like that. The 30 footers were permanently tied to the docks till we could understand what was happening with them, and did a lot of studies, and it turns out it was a dynamically unstable platform.
Huh. I didn't know that about the 30s. You know,
yeah, and that's scary at speed when that thing starts going out from under you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the first time you get that hard shine lockup kind of thing when you're on the face of the wave.
That's right.
Yeah, man, that's a good time, too.
There's some definite indicators that that's happening, so that the school was teaching the 30 SRB course for many years just so people could use those resources again and recognize when that's happening and prevent it before it happens.
It's awesome. Jeff, what a cool, a truly epic career. I love that you got to take him down to Honduras. That's a pretty awesome trip. You got any parting shots for the audience?
You know, anyone wanting a great career, I am obviously biased towards the Coast Guard, but, you know, Coast Guard's also a Department of Homeland Security, so if you're looking for an avenue into law enforcement activities, there it is, and you're not going to get that in any of the other armed services.
Right, and it definitely served you well. Obviously, after your career in the Coast Guard, you kind of finished, you know, your...
Yeah,
Astoria and yeah.
The networking, the people that I've met, the friends that came afterwards, and what I learned in the Coast Guard served me well to transition into managing a 911 center. And
awesome.
Out of almost 16 years, I can truly say I had one bad day.
Awesome. Well, we're so thankful for people like you and just the folks that come before us. And Phil and I, Phil's still in the Coast Guard, and I've been for about 10 years now, so... Just really thankful for the good people that come before us. So thank you. Appreciate it. This was an awesome encounter, an awesome chance to kind of live through your time. So thank you for that, Jeff. Appreciate that.
I appreciate being able to share my story. And again, you know, I did nothing out there alone.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Hats off to, that's right. My crews and teams were superstars, all of them.
When, awesome. I'd say too, Jeff, you know, for anybody that is serving or has served and feels like they're alone, right? You're a good testament that the crew's, you know, the support's still there, right? If you got to talk to somebody, reach
That's
out.
Right.
If reach out,
That's
feel
right.
free. If something happened or whatever it may be, you can reach out to this show. I guarantee you could reach out to Jeff, reach out to anybody, and we'll connect you. We'll make sure that that we get somebody to talk it out.
Definitely, to sit
in the room silently if we have to, you know.
That's right. And it doesn't have to be something of an epic proportion. If you've got something that's bothering you that happened that's service connected or even non-service connected, talk to someone.
Right.
For sure. Come be on the podcast.
Yes.
We'll tell any story you got. You know, it'll be a good time.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, Jeff, hey, so thankful, man, that you did make it out and that you got those so many crews back so many times safely, and that that you shared with us what you went through and the bulk of your career. And we really do appreciate your service, sir, and or chief, I should say, and wish you the best of luck in that that permanent retirement that you just kicked off.
Yes.
You said.
Enjoy it. You deserve it.
Looking forward to it. Yep, we will, and I'm looking forward to living in Texas.
Awesome. Well, hey, if you ever get bored and want to talk, give us give another boss mate a call sometime.
Will do. Thank you so much, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, right. Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Semper Paratus. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.